podcast. All Hit
Radio. This is Stuart Moxon of Young Marble Giants, and you are listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Acre.
Would you like to do a show on WGXC?
Would you like to do a show on WGXC?
Chocolate pig.
I turned it down.
Only dogs can hear. Did you hear that?
No.
Wayfarm respectfully and humbly acknowledges the past, present, and future Indigenous peoples on whose ancestral lands Wayfarm and our radio station, WGXC, operate and broadcast. The Mohicans named themselves the people of the waters that are never still, following their arrival along the Mohicanitta, the Great Ebb Tide River, also known as the Hudson. The Mohicans stewarded this land over many generations in dynamic communication and interaction with diverse Indigenous peoples, including the Haudenosaunee Mohawk and the Munsee Lenape. Mohican descendants today live in communities in Ontario, Wisconsin, and Oklahoma. For further information on Mohican history and the contemporary community of the Stockbridge Munsee Band of Mohican Indians, please visit Mohican.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends and enemies, you're listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas, the name of the show, Good Night Norman, the radio station, WGXC, 90.7 FM, broadcasting to you live from beautiful downtown Hudson, New York. WGXC has offices on Main Street in Catskill, where the actual broadcast center is, but through the miracle of technology, I can be in my own somewhat cozy little apartment. I guess if it's an apartment, it's not my own, is it? adding to the political commentary, I understand these disclaimers about being on Indigenous land, and if you listen closely to that disclaimer, it kind of contradicted itself. The concept of land ownership, of course, is not an Indigenous one. And although they never said property is theft, that was a revolutionary European statement, property is theft. It so turned out for them, now didn't it? Not just the Indigenous Turtle Islanders, but even the Indigenous Europeans before the dominator Europeans decided to leave Europe. Anyways, I try not to editorialize, but seeing as things are as they are, I'm going to read a short piece to begin with from an issue of the quarterly journal Garanta. This was published in the spring of 2002. If you've seen Garanta, or if you haven't, they generally had a theme. And several writers addressed that theme either in fiction or essays. The theme of the issue in spring 2002, the first issue, I think, or maybe the second, that was published after my 40th birthday, 9/11/2001. This issue's theme is What We Think of America, and I'm going to read a piece by Raja Shehadeh. Forgive my inability to correctly enunciate this transliteration of the Arabic name, who was from Palestine. This is from 22 years ago by Palestinian writer Raja Shehadeh. Ever since I was a child, I've been losing friends and relatives to America. I remember one summer afternoon sitting on a green wicker chair, which had first to be cleared of dry pine needles, in the garden of the Ramallah Grand Hotel. Trees rustled in the breeze. I was just 10 years old. My friend, Isa Mitri, and I had been allowed to join a group of older guys who were saying farewell to Isa's brother. He was leaving the next day for the U.S., the first member of his family to emigrate. I had not heard that word before. Did it mean he would never come back? Isa solemnly confirmed that this was so. He was more proud than sad. I looked at his brother, Ilias, a tall, slightly stooped young man with a shy face. He didn't look particularly happy. I could not understand why. Traveling to America was to me, then, like going to heaven. I could not understand why he was not utterly blissful. A few years later, Isa left Ramallah to finish high school in America. This was soon after the 1967 war and Israel's occupation of the West Bank, and the Mitri family had decided he would be safer there. His mother went with him to keep house. His father, who reported for Newsweek, remained alone for a few months and then decided to pack his bags. I remember seeing him before he left and asking him if he was happy to be leaving. There was rancor in his voice as he told me, "I have long been dreaming of the time when I would no longer have to follow your father around to get his comments on the situation." My father was a political maverick. A few days after the war, he had called for a peaceful resolution of the conflict based on the partition of the land into two states, Israel and Palestine. The Palestinian state to be created in the areas occupied by Israel in 1967. That was then a novel proposal, and it earned him few friends among Palestinians or Israelis. There are tens of thousands of Ramallah people, like the Mitris, who have settled permanently in America. The few who come back for brief summer visits parade up and down Main Street in their Bermudas and baseball hats, stopping at the ice cream parlor to reminisce with its proprietor in an old accent that you hardly ever hear in Ramallah today. The migration has been going on since the end of the 19th century. Today, there are more Ramallah people in the U.S. than in Ramallah. Before 1967, that was how most Palestinians related to America, via the good things about the country that they had heard from their migrant friends and relations. After 1967, America entered our life in a different way. After Israel occupied the Palestinian territories, it began almost immediately to claim large areas of land surrounding our towns and villages for the building of Jewish settlements. This was an expensive enterprise. Without American largesse, both official and private, this massive assault on our countryside would not have been possible. When the British ruled Palestine during the Mandate period, they didn't expropriate Arab land to build Jewish settlements. They fulfilled the terms of the Mandate that called for the creation of a national home for the Jews in Palestine in other less provocative and costly ways. The roads they built were cheap. They followed the contours of the hills, and they were still used well after the Mandate ended in May 1948. In the early 80s, when I accompanied my father, whose driving was as perilous as his politics, to the court in Nablus, I would hear him curse the British as he took the turn so abruptly that my stomach jumped. Instead of cutting through in a straight line, they had to go around every damn hill, he would complain. He had just returned from his first trip to the U.S. and was captivated by the American spirit. He believed the Middle East should follow the American example and open up its borders for immigration. The influx of new blood would rid us of our interminable squabbles. How he proposed to convince Israel to abandon its dream of Jewish purity, I never knew. In any case, I had no time to ask. It was only a passing fancy. My father began his legal practice in Jaffa in 1935, when Palestine was still undivided. By the time I began to practice law, the West Bank was under Israeli occupation. On my way to courts in different parts of the country, I could see heavy Israeli machinery flattening the tops of hills. Many of the settlers were enthusiastic American Jews who dreamed of being pioneers. They used the tactics of colonizers everywhere, surveying, mapping, developing spurious legal arguments to justify their plunder, and terrorizing local Palestinians who stood in their way. Transfer was the euphemism used by the Israeli parties which advocated ethnic cleansing. To many Palestinians, it appeared that American money funded this settlement project just as America's pioneering history vindicated it. Within a few years, Israeli settlements came to dominate the Palestinian landscape. Next came the need for new roads to connect them to Israel. Not the old British-style meandering roads, but American-style straight four-lane highways that cut through the hills that stood in the way. Palestine is tiny and its countryside precious, yet by 1984, Israeli planners had developed a fully-fledged road plan which superimposed on the old north-south road grid a scheme of east-west highways that would cut in half the commuting time between the West Bank's new dormitory settlements and the center of Israel. The plan needed billions of American dollars to implement. Funding, again, was no problem. In the context of the Middle East conflict, roads may seem a small thing, but they have done a kind of spiritual damage. Gone is that attractive stretch of serpentine road that meandered downhill into the lower wadi that led into Nablus, an ancient city cupped between the mountains of Ebal and Gerizim. Gone are the gorgeous, dramatic views. Now, the expensive new highway cuts through the hill, and all you can see as you drive is the cutting. But American assistance did not stop at the funding of ideologically motivated programs. Last July, my cousin was at a wedding reception in a hotel on the southern outskirts of Ramallah when an F-16 fighter jet dropped a 100-pound bomb on a nearby building. Everything had been quiet. There had not been any warning of an imminent air attack. The young couple were exchanging rings. The wedding cake was about to be served. When the missile zoomed over the hotel, the aluminum frames of the large French windows were torn asunder. All the glass shattered. The powerful security doors burst out of their frames. The wedding cake became encrusted with glass, and the guests, along with the waiters, all hit the floor. The target, an old house next to the hotel, where the reception was being held, was obliterated. You could not tell that a house had ever stood on that land. Something happened to my cousin that evening. He felt he had been through the worst. He felt he had died, and was surprised afterwards to find he was still alive. He was also emboldened. Fear had been wrested out of him. He did not hate America. He studied there. On his last trip to New York, he had visited the Twin Towers in New York. He fully appreciated the immensity of the tragedy. When the bombing took place, he was worried about his brother, who often takes the Boston-LA flight in the course of his work. Yet when I asked him what he thought of the country, he indicated that he dismissed it as a lackey of Israel, giving it unlimited military assistance and never censoring its use of U.S. weaponry against innocent civilians. Most Americans may never know why my cousin turned his back on their country, but in America, the parts are larger than the whole. It is still possible that the optimism, energy, and opposition of Americans in their diversity may yet turn the tide and make America listen. Anyways, that was written 22 years ago, or published 22 years ago, in the British journal Granta, the magazine of new writing, issue number 77, spring 2002, a contribution by Raja Shehadeh of Palestine to the theme, What We Think of America. They're not all, that's the only Palestinian writer in there. There are others from other countries. Ariel Dorfman from Chile, another country that was upended by the United States foreign interests, etc. There's many. Anyways, enough of that. Since that story kind of begins talking about immigrants to America, I'm going to read from the famous novel The House on Mango Street by Sandra Cisneros for the rest of the show. This one was published in 1984. It takes place in Chicago, USA. La Casa on Mango Street. It was translated I think Cisneros translated it. Anyways, there doesn't seem to be a translator cited in any of the on the title page or anything. This is from a later edition with a 2009 introduction, but anyways, yeah, it was originally published in 1984, The House on Mango Street, by Sandra Cisneros. We didn't always live on Mango Street. Before that, we lived on Loomis, on the third floor. And before that, we lived on Keeler. Before Keeler, it was Paulina, and before that, I can't remember. But what I remember most is moving a lot. Each time it seemed there'd be one more of us. By the time we got to Mango Street, we were six. Mama, Papa, Carlos, Kiki, my sister Nene, and me. The house on Mango Street is ours, and we don't have to pay rent to anybody or share the yard with the people downstairs or be careful not to make too much noise, and there isn't a landlord banging on the ceiling with a broom. But even so, it's not the house we thought we'd get. We had to leave the flat on Loomis quick. The water pipes broke and the landlord wouldn't fix them because the house was too old. We had to leave fast. We were using the washroom next door and carrying water over in empty milk gallons. That's why Mama and Papa looked for a house, and that's why we moved into the house on Mango Street, far away on the other side of town. They always told us that one day we would move into a house, a real house that would be ours for always, so we wouldn't have to move each year. And our house would have running water and pipes that worked. And inside it would have real stairs, not hallway stairs, but stairs inside like the houses on TV. And we'd have a basement and at least three washrooms, so when we took a bath we wouldn't have to tell everybody. Our house would be white with trees around it, a great big yard and grass growing without a fence. This was the house Papa talked about when he held the lottery ticket, and this was the house Mama dreamed up in the stories she told us before we went to bed. But the house on Mango Street is not the way they told it at all. It's small and red with tight steps in front and windows so small you'd think they were holding their breath. Bricks are crumbling in places and the front door is so swollen you have to push hard to get in. There's no front yard, only four little elms the city planted by the curb. Out back is a small garage for the car we don't own yet, and a small yard that looks smaller between the two buildings on either side. There are stairs in our house, but they're ordinary hallway stairs, and the house has only one washroom. Everybody has to share a bedroom, Mama and Papa, Carlos and Kiki, me and Nene. Once, when we were living on Loomis, a nun from my school passed by and saw me playing out front. The laundromat downstairs had been boarded up because it had been robbed 2 days before, and the owner had painted on the wood, "Yes, we're open," so as not to lose business. "Where do you live?" she asked. "There," I said, pointing up to the third floor. "You live there?" "There." I had to look to where she pointed, the third floor. The paint peeling, wooden bars Papa had nailed on the windows so we wouldn't fall out. "You live there?" The way she said it made me feel like nothing. "There. I live there." I nodded. I knew then I had to have a house, a real house, one I could point to. But this isn't it. The house on Mango Street isn't it. "For the time being," Mama says, "temporary," says Papa. But I know how those things go. Everybody in our family has different hair. My Papa's hair is like a broom, all up in the air. And me, my hair is lazy. It never obeys barrettes or bands. Carlos's hair is thick and straight. He doesn't need to comb it. Nene's hair is slippery, slides out of your hand, and Kiki, who is the youngest, has hair like fur. But my mother's hair like little rosettes, like little candy circles all curly and pretty because she pinned it in pin curls all day, sweet to put your nose into when she is holding you and you feel safe, is the warm smell of bread before you bake it. Is the smell when she makes room for you on her side of the bed, still warm with her skin, and you sleep near her, the rain outside falling, and Papa snoring. The snoring, the rain, and Mama's hair that smells like bread. The boys and the girls live in separate worlds, the boys in their universe, and we in ours. My brothers, for example, they've got plenty to say to me and Nene inside the house, but outside they can't be seen talking to girls. Carlos and Kiki are each other's best friend, not ours. Nene is too young to be my friend. She's just my sister, and that was not my fault. You don't pick your sisters, you just get them, and sometimes they come like Nene. She can't play with those Vargas kids, or she'll turn out just like them, and since she comes right after me, she is my responsibility. Someday I will have a best friend all my own, one I can tell my secrets to, one who will understand my jokes without my having to explain them. Until then, I am a red balloon. A balloon tied to an anchor. In English, my name means hope. In Spanish, it means too many letters. It means sadness. It means waiting. It is like the number 9, a muddy color. It is the Mexican records my father plays on Sunday mornings when he is shaving, songs like sobbing. It was my great-grandmother's name, and now it is mine. She was a horsewoman, too, born like me in the Chinese year of the horse, which is supposed to be bad luck if you're born female. But I think this is a Chinese lie because the Chinese, like the Mexicans, don't like their women strong. My great-grandmother, I would have liked to have known her, a wild horse of a woman, so wild she wouldn't marry, until my great-grandfather threw a sack over her head and carried her off, just like that, as if she were a fancy chandelier. That's the way he did it. And the story goes, she never forgave him. She looked out the window her whole life, the way so many women sit their sadness on an elbow. I wonder if she made the best with what she got, or was she sorry because she couldn't be all the things she wanted to be? Esperanza, I have inherited her name, but I don't want to inherit her place by the window. At school, they say my name funny, as if the syllables were made out of tin and hurt the roof of your mouth. But in Spanish, my name is made out of a softer something like silver, not quite as thick as sister's name, Magdalena, which is uglier than mine. Magdalena, who at least can come home and become Nene. But I am always Esperanza. I would like to baptize myself under a new name, a name more like the real one, the one nobody sees. Esperanza as Lisandra or Maritza or Tsetse Tiehe. The X. Yes, something like Tseze the X will do. She says, I am the great-great-grandcousin of the Queen of France. She lives upstairs, over there, next door to Joe, the baby grabber. Keep away from him, she says. He's full of danger. Benny and Blanca own the corner store. They're okay, except don't lean on the candy counter. Two girls, raggedy as rats, live across the street. You don't want to know them. Edna is the lady who owns the building next to you. She used to own a building big as a whale, but her brother sold it. Their mother said, no, no, don't ever sell it. I won't. And then she closed her eyes and he sold it. Alicia is stuck up ever since she went to college. She used to like me, but now she doesn't. Kathy, who is queen of cats, has cats and cats and cats. Baby cats, big cats, skinny cats, sick cats. Cats asleep like little donuts. Cats on top of the refrigerator. Cats taking a walk on the dinner table. Her house is like a cat heaven. You want a friend? She says. Okay, I'll be your friend. But only till next Tuesday. That's when we move away. Got to. Then, as if she forgot I just moved in, she says the neighborhood is getting bad. Kathy's father will have to fly to France one day and find her great-great-distant grand-cousin on her father's side and inherit the family house. How do I know this is so? She told me so. In the meantime, they'll just have to move a little farther north from Mango Street, a little farther away, every time people like us keep moving in. If you give me $5, I will be your friend forever. That's what the little one tells me. $5 is cheap, since I don't have any friends except Kathy, who is only my friend till Tuesday. $5. She is trying to get somebody to chip in so they can buy a bicycle from this kid named Tito. They already have $10, and all they need is 5 more. Only $5, she says. Don't talk to them, says Kathy. Can't you see they smell like a broom? But I like them. Their clothes are crooked and old. They are wearing shiny Sunday shoes without socks. It makes their bald ankles all red, but I like them. Especially the big one who laughs with all her teeth. I like her even though she lets the little one do all the talking. $5, the little one says, only five. Kathy is tugging my arm, and I know whatever I do next will make her mad forever. Wait a minute, I say, and run inside to get the $5. I have $3 saved, and I take two of Nene's. She's not home, but I'm sure she'll be glad when she finds out we own a bike. When I get back, Kathy is gone like I knew she would be, but I don't care. I have two new friends and a bike, too. My name is Lucy, the big one says. This here is Rachel, my sister. I'm her sister, says Rachel. Who are you? And I wish my name was Cassandra or Alexis or Maritza, anything but Esperanza. But when I tell them my name, they don't laugh. We come from Texas, Lucy says and grins. Her was born here, but me, I'm Texas. You mean she, I say. No, I'm from Texas, and doesn't get it. This bike is 3 ways ours, says Rachel, who is thinking ahead already. Mine today, Lucy's tomorrow, and yours day after. But everybody wants to ride it today because the bike is new. So we decide to take turns after tomorrow. Today it belongs to all of us. I don't tell them about Nene just yet. It's too complicated, especially since Rachel almost put out Lucy's eye about who was going to get to ride it first. But finally, we agreed to ride it together. Why not? Because Lucy has long legs, she pedals. I sit on the back seat, and Rachel is skinny enough to get up on the handlebars, which makes the bike all wobbly as if the wheels are spaghetti, but after a bit, you get used to it. We ride fast and faster, past my house, sad and red and crumbly in places, past Mr. Benny's grocery on the corner, and down the avenue, which is dangerous. Laundromat, junk store, drug store, windows and cars and more cars, and around the block back to Mango. People on the bus wave. A very fat lady crossing the street says, "You sure got quite a load there." Rachel shouts, "You got quite a load there, too." She's very sassy. Down, down Mango Street we go. Rachel, Lucy, me. Our new bicycle. Laughing the crooked ride back. Nene and I don't look like sisters. Not right away. Not the way you can tell with Rachel and Lucy, who have the same fat popsicle lips like everybody else in their family. But me and Nene, we are more alike than you would know. Our laughter, for example. Not the shy ice cream bells giggle of Rachel and Lucy's family, but all of a sudden and surprised like a pile of dishes breaking. And other things I can't explain. One day we were passing a house that looked, in my mind, like houses I had seen in Mexico. I don't know why. There was nothing about the house that looked exactly like the houses I remembered. I'm not even sure why I thought that, but it seemed to feel right. Look at that house, I said. It looks like Mexico. Rachel and Lucy looked at me like I'm crazy, but before they can let out a laugh, Nene says, "Yes, that's Mexico, all right. That's what I was thinking exactly." There is a junk store. An old man owns it. We bought a used refrigerator from him once, and Carlos sold a box of magazines for $1. The store is small with just a dirty window for light. He doesn't turn the lights on unless you got money to buy things with, so in the dark we look and see all kinds of things, me and Nene. Tables with their feet upside down and rows of refrigerators with round corners and couches that spin dust in the air when you punch them and 100 TVs that don't work properly. Everything is on top of everything, so the whole store has skinny aisles to walk through. You can get lost easy. The owner, he is a black man who doesn't talk much, and sometimes if you didn't know better, you could be in there a long time before your eyes notice a pair of gold glasses floating in the dark. Nene, who thinks she is smart and talks to any old man, asks a lot of questions. Me, I never said nothing to him, except once when I bought the Statue of Liberty for a dime. But Nene, I hear her asking one time, "How's this here?" And the man says, "This is a music box." And I turn around quick, thinking he means a pretty box with flowers painted on it with a ballerina inside. Only there's nothing like that where this old man is pointing. Just a wood box that's old and got a big brass record in it with holes. Then he starts it up, and all sorts of things start happening. It's like all of a sudden he let go a million moths all over the dusty furniture and swan neck shadows and in our bones. It's like drops of water, or like marimbas, only with a funny little plucked sound to it, like if you were running your fingers across the teeth of a metal comb. And then, I don't know why, but I have to turn around and pretend I don't care about the box so Nene won't see how stupid I am. But Nene, who is stupider, already is asking how much, and I can see her fingers going for the quarters in her pants pocket. "This," the old man says, shutting the lid, "this ain't for sale." Meme Ortiz moved into Kathy's house after her family moved away. His name isn't really Meme. His name is Juan. But when we asked him what his name was, he said Meme. And that's what everybody calls him, except his mother. Meme has a dog with gray eyes, a sheepdog with two names, one in English and one in Spanish. The dog is big, like a man dressed in a dog suit, and runs the same way its owner does, clumsy and wild, with the limbs flopping all over the place like untied shoes. Kathy's father built the house Meme moved into. It is wooden. Inside, the floors slant. Some rooms uphill, some down. And there are new closets. Out front, there are 21 steps, all lopsided and jutting like crooked teeth. Made that way on purpose, Kathy said, so the rain will slide off. And when Meme's mama calls from the doorway, Meme goes scrambling up the 21 wooden stairs with the dog with two names scrambling after him. Around the back is a yard, mostly dirt and a greasy bunch of boards that used to be a garage. But what you remember most is this tree, huge, with fat arms and mighty families of squirrels and higher branches. All around the neighborhood of roofs, black-tarred and A-framed, and in their gutters the balls that never came back down to earth. Down at the base of the tree, the dog with two names barks into the empty air, and there at the end of the block, looking smaller still, our house, with its feet tucked under, like a cat. This is the tree we chose for the first annual Tarzan jumping contest. Meme won and broke both arms. Downstairs from Meme's is a basement apartment that Meme's mother fixed up and rented to a Puerto Rican family, Louis's family. Louis is the oldest in a family of little sisters. He is my brother's friend, really, but I know he has two cousins and that his T-shirts never stay tucked in his pants. Louis's girl cousin is older than us. She lives with Louis's family because her own family is in Puerto Rico. Her name is Marin or Maris or something like that, and she wears dark nylons all the time and lots of makeup she gets free from selling Avon. She can't come out. Got to babysit with Louis's sisters, but she stands in the doorway, all the time singing, clicking her fingers, the same song. Apples, peaches, pumpkin pie, you're in love and so am I. Yeah. Louis has another cousin. We only saw him once, but it was important. We were playing volleyball in the alley when he drove up in this great big yellow Cadillac with white walls and yellow scarf tied around the mirror. Louis's cousin had his arm out the window. He honked a couple of times, and a lot of faces looked out from Louis's back window, and then a lot of people came out, Louis, Marin, and all the little sisters. Everybody looked inside the car and asked where he got it. There were white rugs and white leather seats. We all asked for a ride and asked where he got it. Louis's cousin said, get in. We each had to sit with one of Louie's little sisters on our lap, but that was okay. The seats were big and soft like a sofa, and there was a little white cat in the back window whose eyes lit up when the car stopped or turned. The windows didn't roll up like an ordinary car's. Instead, there was a button that did it for you automatically. We rode up the alley and around the block 6 times, but Louie's cousin said he was going to make us walk home if we didn't stop playing with the windows or touching the FM radio. The 7th time we drove into the alley, we heard sirens, real quiet at first, but then louder. Louie's cousin stopped the car right where we were and said, "Everybody out of the car!" Then he took off, flooring that car into a yellow blur. We hardly had time to think when the cop car pulled in the alley, going just as fast. We saw the yellow Cadillac at the end of the block trying to make a left-hand turn, but our alley is too skinny and the car crashed into a lamppost. Marin screamed, and we ran down the block to where the cop's car siren spun a dizzy blue. The nose of that yellow Cadillac was all pleated like an alligator's, and except for a bloody lip and a bruised forehead, Louis's cousin was okay. They put handcuffs on him and put him in the back seat of the cop car, and we all waved as they drove away. Sorry, I had to wet my whistle there. You listen to me, your host, Norman Douglas. Name of the show, Goodnight Norman, the radio station, WGXC 90.7 FM. With offices on Main Street in downtown and broadcast studio and on Main Street in downtown Catskill, New York. WGXC.org on the worldwide interweb. Tonight, Sandra Cisneros, The House on Mango Street, which is actually a novel, but it's broken up into very short chapters that are kind of like stories. Not unlike Jesus' Son by Dennis Johnson, which I'm not reading tonight. So I'll continue here. I'm not reading the titles of these chapters either. I don't know, maybe I should, but I'm not. Sandra Cisneros, The House on Mango Street, was published in 1984. Again, there's no translator listed, so I'm guessing because she is bilingual, the La Casa and Mango Street was translated by her, or maybe written simultaneously. I think Borges did that kind of thing. Anyways, here's the next chapter, The House on Mango Street, from 1984 by Sandra Cisneros. Marin's boyfriend is in Puerto Rico. She shows us his letters and makes us promise not to tell anybody they're getting married when she goes back to PR. She says he didn't get a job yet, but she's saving the money she gets from selling Yvonne and taking care of her cousins. Marin says that if she stays here next year, she's going to get a real job downtown because that's where the best jobs are, since you always get to look beautiful and get to wear nice clothes and can meet someone in the subway who might marry you and take you to live in a big house far away. But next year, Louie's parents are going to send her back to her mother with a letter saying she's too much trouble and that is too bad because I like Marin. She is older and knows lots of things. She is the one who told us how Davy, the baby's sister, got pregnant and what cream is best for taking off mustache hair, and if you count the white flecks on your fingernails, you can know how many boys are thinking of you and lots of other things I can't remember now. We never see Marin until her aunt comes home from work, and even then she can only stay out in front. She is there every night with the radio. When the light in her aunt's room goes out, Marin lights a cigarette, and it doesn't matter if it's cold out or if the radio doesn't work or if we've got nothing to say to each other. What matters, Marin says, is for the boys to see us and for us to see them. And since Marin's skirts are shorter and since her eyes are pretty and since Marin is already older than us in many ways, the boys who do pass by say stupid things like, "I am in love with those two green apples you call eyes. Give them to me, why don't you?" and Marine just looks at them without even blinking and is not afraid. Marine, under the streetlight, dancing by herself, is singing the same song somewhere, I know, is waiting for a car to stop, a star to fall, someone to change her life. Those who don't know any better come into our neighborhood scared. They think we're dangerous. They think we will attack them with shiny knives. They are stupid people who are lost and got here by mistake. But we aren't afraid. We know the guy with the crooked eyes is Davy the baby's brother. And the tall one next to him in the straw brim, that's Rosa's, Eddie V. And the big one that looks like a dumb grown man, he's Fat Boy. Though he's not fat anymore. Nor a boy. All brown all around, we are safe. But watch us drive into a neighborhood of another color, and our knees go shakety-shake, and our car windows get rolled up tight, and our eyes look straight. Yeah, that is how it goes and goes. Rosa Vargas' kids are too many and too much. It's not her fault, you know, except she is their mother and only one against so many. They are bad, those Vargases, and how can they help it with only one mother who is tired all the time from buttoning and bottling and babying and who cries every day for the man who left without even leaving a dollar for bologna or a note explaining how come? The kids bend trees and bounce between cars and dangle upside down from knees and almost break like fancy museum vases you can't replace. They think it's funny. They're without respect for all things living, including themselves. Sorry. But after a while, you get tired of being worried about kids who aren't even yours. One day, they are playing chicken on Mr. Benny's roof. Mr. Benny says, "Hey, ain't your kids no better than to be swinging up there? Come down right now." And then they just spit. See, that's what I mean. No wonder everybody gave up. Just stopped looking out when little Efren chipped his buck tooth on a parking meter and didn't even stop Refugia from getting her head stuck between two slats in the back gate. And nobody looked up not once the day Angel Vargas learned to fly and dropped from the sky like a sugar donut, just like a falling star, and exploded down to earth without even an O. "Close your eyes and they'll go away," her father says, "or you're just imagining. And anyway, a woman's place is sleeping so she can wake up early with a tortilla star, the one that appears early just in time to rise and catch the hind legs hide behind the sink, beneath the four-clawed tub, under the swollen floorboards nobody fixes, in the corners of your eyes. Alicia, whose mama died, is sorry there is no one older to rise and make the lunchbox tortillas. Alicia, who inherited her mama's rolling pin and sleepiness, is young and smart and studies for the first time at the university. Two trains and a bus. Because she doesn't want to spend her whole life in a factory or behind a rolling pin. Is a good girl, my friend. Studies all night and sees the mice, the ones her father says do not exist. Is afraid of nothing except four-legged fur and fathers. You can never have too much sky. You can fall asleep and wake up drunk on sky, and sky can keep you safe when you are sad. Here there is too much sadness and not enough sky. Butterflies, too, are few, and so are flowers and most things that are beautiful. Still, we take what we can get and make the best of it. Darius, who doesn't like school, who is sometimes stupid and mostly a fool, said something wise today, though most days he says nothing. Darius, who chases girls with firecrackers or a stick that touched a rat and thinks he's tough, today pointed up because the world was full of clouds, the kind like pillows. You all see that cloud? That fat one there? Darius said. See that? Where? That one next to the one that looked like popcorn. That one there. See that? That's God, Darius said. God, somebody little asked. God, he said, and made it simple. The Eskimos got 30 different names for snow, I say. I read it in a book. I got a cousin, Rachel says. She's got 3 different names. There ain't 30 different kinds of snow, Lucy says. There are 2 kinds, the clean kind and the dirty kind. Clean and dirty, only 2. There are 1,000,000,000 zillion kinds, says Nene. No 2 exactly alike, only how do you remember which one is which? She got 3 last names and, let me see, 2 first names. 1 in English, 1 in Spanish. And clouds got at least 10 different names, I say. Names for clouds, Nene asks. Names just like you and me. That up there, that's cumulus. And everybody looks up. Cumulus are cute, Rachel says. She would say something like that. Was that one there, Nene asked, pointing a finger. That's cumulus, too. They're all cumulus today. Cumulus, cumulus, cumulus. No, she says. That there is Nancy, otherwise known as Pig Eye. And over there, her cousin Mildred, and little Joey, Marco, Nerida, and Sue. There are all different kinds of clouds. How many different kinds of clouds can you think of? Well, there's these already that look like shaving cream. And what about the kind that looks like you combed its hair? Yes, those are clouds too. Phyllis, Ted, Alfredo, and Julie. There are clouds that look like big fields of sheep, Rachel says. Them are my favorite. And don't forget Nimbus the rain cloud, I add. That's something. Jose, Nagoberto, Alicia, Raul, Edna, Alma, Ricky. That's that wide, puffy cloud that looks like your face when you wake up after falling asleep with all your clothes on. Reynaldo, Angelo, Alberto, Armando, Mario. Not my face, looks like your fat face. Rita, Margie, Ernie. Whose fat face? Esperanza's fat face, that's who. Looks like Esperanza's ugly face when she comes to school in the morning. Anita, Stella, Dennis, and Lolo. Well, who are you calling ugly, ugly? Richie, Yolanda, Hector, Stevie, Vincent. Not you. Your mama, that's who. My mama, you better not be saying that, Lucy Guerrero. You better not be talking like that, as you can say goodbye to being my friend forever. I'm saying your mama ugly like bare feet in September. That does it. Both of you better get out of my yard before I call my brothers. Oh, we're only playing. I can think of 30 Eskimo words for you, Rachel. 30 words that say what you are. Oh, yeah, well, I can think of some more. Uh-oh, Nene, better get the broom. Too much trash in the yard today. Frankie, Licha, Maria, Pee-wee. Nene, you better tell your sister she is really crazy because Lucy and me are never coming back here again, forever. Reggie, Elizabeth, Lisa, Louie. You can do what you want to do, Nene, but you better not talk to Lucy or Rachel if you want to be my sister. You know what you are, Esperanza? You are like the cream of wheat cereal. You're like the lumps. Yeah, and you foot fleas, that's you. Chicken lips, cockroach jelly, cold frijoles. Your mama's frijoles. Your ugly mama's toes. That's stupid. Pepe, Blanca, Benny. Who's stupid? Rachel, Lucy, Esperanza, and Nene. There was a family, all were little. Their arms were little, and their hands were little, and their height was not tall, and their feet was very small. The grandpa slept on the living room couch and snored. through his teeth. His feet were fat and doughy like thick tamales, and these he powdered and stuffed into white socks and brown leather shoes. The grandma's feet were lovely as pink pearls and dressed in velvety high heels that made her walk with a wobble, but she wore them anyway because they were pretty. The baby's feet had 10 tiny toes, pale and see-through like a salamander's, and these he popped into his mouth whenever he was hungry. The mother's feet, plump and polite, descended like white pigeons from the sea of pillow across the linoleum roses, down the wooden stairs, down over the chalk hopscotch squares, 5, 6, 7, blue sky. "Do you want this?" and gave us a paper bag with one pair of lemon shoes and one red and one pair of dancing shoes that used to be white but were now pale blue. "Here," and we said thank you, and waited until she went upstairs. "Hooray! Today we are Cinderella because our feet fit exactly, and we laugh at Rachel's one foot with a girl's gray sock and a lady's high heel. Do you like these shoes? But the truth is, it is scary to look down at your foot that is no longer yours and see attached a long, long leg. Everybody wants to trade. The lemon shoes for the red shoes, the red for the pair that were once white but are now pale blue, the pale blue for the lemon, and take them off and put them back on and keep on like this a long time until we are tired. Then Lucy screams to take our socks off, and yes, it's true, we have legs, skinny and spotted with satin scarves, scars where scabs were picked, but legs all our own, good to look at and long. It's late Rachel who learns to walk the best, all strutted in those magic high heels. She teaches us to cross and uncross our legs and to run like a double Dutch rope and how to walk down to the corner so that the shoes talk back to you with every step. Lucy, Rachel, me teetottering like so, down to the corner where the men can't take their eyes off us. We must be Christmas. Mr. Benny at the corner grocery puts down his important cigar. "Your mother know you got shoes like that? Who give you those?" "Nobody. Them are dangerous," he says. "You girls too young to be wearing shoes like that. Take them shoes off before I call the cops." But we just run. On the avenue, a boy on a homemade bicycle calls out, "Ladies, lead me to heaven." But there is nobody around but us. "Do you like these shoes?" Rachel says yes, and Lucy says yes, and yes, I say, "These are the best shoes. We will never go back to wearing the other kind again. Do you like these shoes?" In front of the laundromat, 6 girls with the same fat face pretend we are invisible. They are the cousins, Lucy says, and always jealous. We just keep strutting. Across the street, in front of the tavern, a bum on the stoop. "Do you like these shoes?" Bum man says yes. "Yes, little girl. Your little lemon shoes are so beautiful, but come closer. I can't see very well. Come closer, please." "You're a pretty girl," bum man continues. "What's your name, pretty girl?" And Rachel says, "Rachel," just like that. Now, you know, to talk to drunks is crazy, and to tell them your name is worse, but who can blame her? She is young and dizzy to hear so many sweet things in one day, even if it is a bum man's whiskey words saying them. "Rachel, you are prettier than a yellow taxi cab. You know that?" But we don't like it. "We got to go," Lucy says. "If I give you a dollar, will you kiss me?" "How about a dollar?" "I give you a dollar," and he looks in his pocket for wrinkled money. "We have to go right now," Lucy says, taking Rachel's hand, because she looks like she's thinking about that dollar, and the bum is yelling something to the air, but by now we're running fast and far away, our high-heeled shoes taking us all the way down the avenue and around the block, past the ugly cousins, past Mr. Benny's, up Mango Street, the back way just in case. We're tired of being beautiful. Lucy hides the lemon shoes and the red shoes and the shoes that used to be white but are now pale blue under a powerful bushel basket on the back porch until one Tuesday her mother, who's very clean, throws them away, but no one complains. All right, that's it. You've been listening. Good night, Norman. This is your host, Norman Douglas, signing off. You've been listening to me read Sandra Cisneros, The House on Mango Street. And, 2 weeks from now, you can tune in